Hello, welcome to Heroes Special on Midnight Feast. I'm Gareth and this is Bernadette.
It's actually Heroes and Villains.
Heroes and Villains,
important
sorry.
Important to remember the villains. This is the first of two Heroes and Villains podcasts. And this first story is called Survival Monologue and it's by Molly Sweeney. We have been having one of those weekends. Sylvia is off on a trip to Scotland on Monday with a guide. It's all very adventurous. And of course, she's had weeks to organise everything, but where's my hat? My Macintosh is spiteful. Why is Rachel always borrowing my things? But I had to go and buy her a case, as the ones we have are all too big. They have to be 24 times 18 inches maximum, apparently, or they're frankly too nice to be taken up with a lot of girls to be traipsed around the Highlands. I do feel for the poor guide mistress. She looks about 20. They'll probably walk all over her. There was a case I thought would suit. My father had the perfect sized one, and you know he loves giving us things, passing things along down the generation. Since we came here, he's never been one for keeping for best. I suppose we left a lot of things behind, all that beautiful crockery and fine clothes and the good knives, for some imaginary day that will be worthy of them. Who knows where they are now? But, well, we went round for Friday night, and I asked him about it. The case that would be the perfect size.
No.
Oh, but it would be perfect. And you know, it's probably so old that it's antique. Sylvia was very good, actually. She said it would be fab. She knows how he likes to be helpful.
No!
And his voice, it was... he was angry and hard. All right, then. I need to go into town tomorrow anyway, so we will just have to be even more careful with their things. When dinner was over and the children were going over their Hebrew, I went upstairs. Mrs. Hyman comes every day except Friday and Saturday. I like to check things over, not quite running a white glove across the skirting boards, but just making sure that everything's in order. The case was on top of the wardrobe where I knew it would be. Brown and the perfect size for a week's trip. Perfect for a young girl to carry. Downstairs, they were laughing, talking. I got the chair and stood on it, and I got the case in my hands. It wasn't dusty. I laid it on the bed and opened it. There were banknotes. Lots and lots of pound notes, I mean hundreds. And 100 US dollar. And there was a Thomas Cook timetable for the trains in Europe from last year. And a brochure for British Airways and a list of contact details of bookings for ports. Details of how to get to Portsmouth, Southampton. His passport. Ordnance survey maps. Oh dear. I'm so sorry. Very silly of me. 30 years. He needs to know that he can get away. And all of this stuff was nestling in the black coat. I took it out. It's a dusty, faded black now. I remember it used to belong to my cousin, Frida. Frida was ever so glamorous, and I felt so grown up when it became mine. I remember my mother's stitching star before I even saw the little yellow star. How careful, how precise, how even though she was so fast, each little stitch was perfect. I remember her sitting by one candle in the kitchen sewing, and I was still learning and wanted to be helpful, so I asked if I could do it.
No, it needs to be done properly.
And my mother did it properly. Three yellow stars on three ragged coats. I don't believe that that was fear. It was pride in a job well done. She got out a scrap of old curtain and traced out the stars on a newspaper and cut out the material and sewed them on, turning in the edges so they wouldn't fray. And my little star stayed on for 30 years.
Well, go on now into the bedroom and turn down the beds and get into your nightdress.
But...
when your father comes home, you want things to be nice and tidy and ready for him, don't you? So he can tell your story.
She smiled. In the candlelight, it was a ghostly smile. The next day, I wore that coat as I hurried along streets I will never see again. As I kept my head down, I traced my fingers over the stitching. I kept the sign of my evilness, my disgustingness, my un-Germanness to that glamorous black coat. I felt a tiny surge of something warm and bright. My father wasn't a Jew, which is hilarious now, as we come round for Shabbat and he talks with all the old Jewish men in London with long beards and sad eyes. But he was born a Lutheran. Perhaps having lived as a Jew, he would like to die a Lutheran too. Rather difficult to ask without seeming morbid. But Mother was. A long line of Jews, a long bloodline of women, reaching far back to before Germany was even a concept. So Father and I were to go to England, and Mother was to join us separately.
Mother can't come with us. I could only get 2 tickets.
I wanted to ask why Mother and I couldn't go together on the 2 tickets. Father couldn't cook or sew, and I'd have to go into public lavatories on my own. And this seemed like it would be a long journey, with lots and lots of public lavatories. But I didn't. Instead, I packed that little brown case with only sensible things. And Father said,
I know that you're such a grown-up girl you wouldn't want to bring anything silly and babyish and that you don't need.
And I hated when he said things like that, because then I had to be grown up. And so my father and I went on a long train journey, and then another long train journey, and then a long walk. And then we got on a boat, and Father was sick into a little bucket every single day. And then England. I still remember how strange everyone sounded, how English sounded so nasal and so old. I remember how damp and grey, and the food, and that tiresome English attitude, as if there was something admirable in its unpleasantness. Mother was to join us a week after we'd arrived, the next Monday. Before I left, she told me she would wave the moment she got on the gangplank. I could see down at all the people waiting at the port, so that I would be sure to spot her immediately, and that we would be parted for the shortest time possible. I looked and I looked at every single person as they first stepped onto the gangplank. I did not move my eyes from that spot until the gangplank was lifted up, and I never saw my mother. She wasn't on the boat. We went home to the little room we rented. My father lay on the bed face down and shook. The landlady gave me cocoa and said soft, nasally words. From my first month in England, I got by with just a jersey and lots of running around. But then one day my father stopped me before I was going out to play.
Coat!
I shook my head, and after a lot of huffing about what a naughty girl I was and how I shouldn't play out in the street if I thought I could shake my head like a gutter snipe at my father, I snatched the coat out of the wardrobe and held it out to him. He stopped short as he realised, embarrassed and almost amused. But as he kissed me on the cheek by way of apology, I could feel the dampness threatening his eyes and face. He sniffed and went downstairs. I was relieved. He was going to beg a coat from the landlady. It took him a while to get what he wanted with his halting English. But he returned triumphant and held a little stitch unpicker in his thin, clever fingers. I threw the coat to the opposite side of the room. I stood in front of it and I screamed. My throat hurt after the first 5 seconds, but I carried on for a good 5 minutes. He was not to touch that coat. My father tried to reassure me, gently, firmly, angrily, that I was in England. No need for any yellow star. I was a stubborn little blighter about it. He was not to touch that coat. I told him even if I was beaten until I couldn't stand, I would not let him touch that coat. And he gave up eventually. The coat was put away. For when I was ready to stop being a baby, he said, a coat far, far too big for me was found. And I spent my first winter in England twirling around like a pantomime villain. My mother had been caught the day after we left. Just in time. She died on a train. I met a survivor who said they remembered her. And the man told me hesitatingly, haltingly, that he took her coat when she'd died. I said I understood, even though of course I couldn't possibly. The coat had been taken along with everything else when they reached the camp, and I wondered how long it took them to unpick that yellow star. Thank you, Molly Sweeney.
Molly Sweeney. This next story is called Comic Book Hero. It's by Stephen Keyworth. He lifted the trousers from the rail and held them up. He was a big man, and the cloth legs dangled above the floor, kicking helplessly. The shop assistant was upon him immediately, wearing a practiced smile. "And what size does your wife usually take?" "Oh, this is not for my wife," he said. "Do you have somewhere I could try them on?"
"Yes,"
said the shop assistant, a little uncertain now. You do know that this is a maternity department?
Of course, said the man. I'm not an idiot.
And with an irritable swish, the man, also known as the Hulk, went off to get changed. Looking in the mirror, he felt the trousers are still not quite right. There was an elasticated panel which the Hulk guessed was designed to stretch around the bump of a pregnant woman. Could it be the answer to his problem?
They're a little loose, said the assistant, still hovering. Maybe you should try a smaller size?
He shook his head. No, they need to be as large as possible and stretchy, very stretchy.
What about a different colour then? Something that goes with your skin tone?
No, it has to be purple.
He took a deep breath to calm himself. Why wouldn't the shop assistant leave him alone? He was short-tempered at the best of times, but recently the tiniest thing could tip him over the edge.
The drinking didn't help. Last night, he got into a state and called his ex. Usually he was too far gone to dial a number, but since he got voice-activated dialing, Sarah wasn't impressed. She'd given him another lecture about his failure to communicate. He hadn't been supportive when her mother went into hospital. She needed an apology. She needed a man who was braver emotionally. But all he could do was growl down the telephone. Hulk, smash! Hulk, smash!
These thoughts must have shown in his face because the shop assistant was looking at him funny. Funnier.
Are you okay?
Yeah. He remembered what Sarah had said. No. I've been going through stuff recently. I thought there might be something here that would help.
The girl nodded.
I split with my boyfriend 4 months ago. And I went over and got my hair cut short. It's growing back now.
The Hulk nodded. Although he wasn't entirely sure that this was the same thing.
You do what you gotta do to get yourself better. And if you think trousers will make you happy,
I'll take them.
Ooh. Do you want me to put them in a bag for you?
Yes, please. The dreaded shopping trip was over. Now, if we could just get home without any of those incidents involving police cars and screaming people, then maybe one day Sarah would believe that he wasn't a complete disaster.
I'm sorry, but your card's been declined. The girl pulled her face. I should have known that you'll be one of those.
The Hulk looked at her. Don't make me angry, he said.
Brilliant. Stephen Keyworth, there was Comic Book Hero. Thank you, Stephen.
This is Batman versus Wonder Girl by Ahmed Siddiqui. I hope I've said your name right, Ahmed. Batman versus Wonder Girl.
Phil, I don't do Paul.
Harry, I'm not suggesting that at all. Even down the phone, I can sense him sitting back in his chair, smiling. I just think it could be stronger.
Stronger? Meaning what exactly?
Oh, you know, you've seen all the new stuff up on the Kindle site. There's no need to be so English about this. These new guys, their stuff is, you know, stronger.
Phil, I don't do porn.
I'll give you an example from your last manuscript. It's great stuff, by the way. It's just that, look, page 55. The rooftop conversation. Wonder Girl treating Batman's wounds. You describe the way she looks into his eyes, the touching. Then just as we get into the, you know, the nub of the action, you cut away to the secretary being kidnapped. I mean, come on.
Phil is called delayed gratification.
And then the secretary's in the warehouse and all these villains, and well, she's young, right? She's tied up, her clothes are ripped, she's surrounded by all these burly men, and she just tells them where the microphone is, and they all leave to find it. It's such a wasted opportunity.
Phil, I don't do porn.
Of course, look, this sounds like a criticism, but it's not. Let's discuss later. You're off to the convention soon, right? Have a great time. Sell loads of stuff. And don't forget the costume. Yeah? On the bus, I think about what he said. I'm an author. I work in a particular genre, and I know I need to be responsive to the market. But what Phil wants is too much in every way. I don't even know I can write about the kinky stuff he's talking about. Tying people up? I can't be alienating my readers.
They could all be old ladies in Cardiff dreaming of Wonder Woman finally kissing Batnight. My heroes always battle between their public duty and their personal desires, duty and love. Not mere sex, but love. Heroes are always alone, by choice, but they're all still human. They need the closeness of another, even though it might never be consummated. Laugh, but this is the truth of my art. In the hotel, I find the toilets to change. It takes a while. The Batnight costume's cumbersome and I'm aware I've put on weight since I purchased it. You see, authors don't need six packs or steely sinews. Sitting at the stall and under the large black cape and rubber armour, few will see my writer's paunch straining against the grey spandex. This was one of Phil's ideas. They don't want you, Harry. They want the Batnight. And therefore, to promote the 100% unofficial Batnight in Love series, I should become the Batnight, just like in the movies. I stuff my normal clothes into a plastic bag and creak off to my desk at the back of the hall, rubber thigh pads chafing. As I sit to await punters, I notice Gerald Stahl, once my cover artist, he's since moved on to do lucrative, personalised commissions. He's now easily the best-known comic artist from Antwerp. A small sign on his desk says, erotic commissions taken. This morning is quiet, so I shuffle over to talk. What do they want, Harry? They wanted hardcore. They want Steelman doing Spider Mistress. They say, I want Spider Mistress like so, and Steelman like so. Or maybe they want Steelman doing Captain Canada. Anything. I take maybe 20 commissions this weekend. Maybe up to 2,000 euros each. Nice, eh? Yeah, sure. 2,000 for poster size. I charge by size and number of characters. Last year, I did wall-size orgy. 30,000 euros. 1 month's work, man. Sometimes I ask the crazy stuff, you know? Like feet or pee-pee. Tentacles, machines. The imagination, crazy, no? I feel slightly ill. Even if I wanted to do smart, I'm not sure I could imagine those kind of desires. What with my devotion to the books, I haven't had a girlfriend for a while, but had taste changed that much? Tentacles? The day's slow and it's hot in the rubber suit. A few passers-by walk up to the desk. Two or three buy books, but most just want me to say, I'm Batnight, in the rasping voice used in the films. Tired and annoyed, I begin to think about packing up and putting the costume back into the Tesco bag. And then, Wonder Girl walks over. She's tall, just like the comics, with long, lustrous black hair, broad hips, endless legs and a proudly horizontal chest. The costume's perfect. The red and gold busty are bringing out the curves of her body, pneumatic and structural. How much? She points at my books. Her voice is deep, husky, but uniquely feminine. £10 each, or the box set of five for £40. She picks up the box set easily, gripping it in one strong hand. With the other, she squeezes two fingers between her breasts. I see the flesh ease out of the way and she pushes in, up to the knuckle and slowly wiggles the finger around. She withdraws two 20s, throws them at me and walks away. I stare at her backside, swaying slightly, resplendent in star-spangled blue. Stunned, I hold the cash in my hand, the notes still warm from her bosom. Unfolding them, I find a small card with handwritten words. Follow me. Now. What does this mean? What could she want? Mistaken identity, surely. She strides away to the exit. As she walks, I stare at the muscles in her thighs, flexing the way they press against the buttocks. Leaving the stall behind, I rise to follow, waddling as fast as a rubber suit will let me. I find her standing next to the lift. I'm terribly sorry to bother you, but you gave me this note by mistake and I... Let's go. She holds the lift door open. I follow. She's over a foot taller than me. My eyes are at breast level. Look, I just think you must have had me confused with... I can't seem to get the words out.
I've been fascinated by your work for a while, Harry. Its possibilities are very inspiring.
I try to make eye contact, but I can barely see for the sweat running over my eyes, the rubber mask clawing against my face. I follow her out at the 15th floor.
There's so much we need to discuss, Harry.
In the royal suite, she lays back on the stadium-sized bed, stretching her body, arching and twisting, unfurling generous curves, grinding muscle into the deep mattress.
Why don't you get out of that costume?
It's not a question, it's an order. I begin fumbling at my array of clips and locks and zips. My hands are shaking and wet with perspiration. I unpeel the spandex stuck to me with moisture, my belly flopping out, my poor thin skin shining with sweat. She's on her knees on the bed. In front of her there are lengths of rope or maybe rubber tubing. That night is on the floor and I stand naked and stare. I taste blood in my mouth. I don't understand. What's happening? Why can't I stop this? She picks up a tornado-shaped black object. There's a car battery on the bed. A string of spheres, bottles. She glares at me, teeth clenched.
Oh, bad night. I'm gonna eat you right up.
Harry, it's Phil. Been trying to catch you for days. Thanks for the new chapter. I see you've had a wave of, inspiration?
Oh?
I don't know what to say. I'm really glad you've had a change of heart since that chat. It's so good to see you branching out and it's so brave. But this is disgusting.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, this is really extreme. What brought this on? Actually, I don't want to know. This is really, really revolting. And I once spent a week off my face in Bangkok. There are things here they wouldn't use in Guantanamo. Harry, we can't touch this. I don't even want it on the office computers. If you choose this direction, I don't think we'll be able to publish you. Harry, are you there?
Okay. Thanks, Phil. Bye. I hang up.
Who was that? She asks. I bet it was nobody important, was it, Batnight? It's just you and me now, isn't it? With our imaginations.
She attaches the electrodes, and I look at my Amazonian and nod, unable to speak.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
That was Bat Knight versus Wonder Girl by the fantastic Ahmed Siddiqui. Thank you very much for that, Ahmed.
This next story is called But Brendan Slept On. It's by Nigel Munson. Brendan had been asked to keep an eye on the gate. Under no circumstances was he to open it, unless a beautiful red-haired maiden on a beautiful grey-haired horse came a-knocking, in which case he was to let her in immediately. In fact, if he didn't let in the beautiful red-haired maiden on the beautiful grey-haired horse the moment she knocked upon the gate, then she would be in grave danger, and so too would the entire kingdom. For she possessed a great many secrets, secrets that could be revealed to no man but... Yes, 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 said Brendan, upon receiving his instructions. I get it, there's no need to go on. After all, I have my trusty hound with me. He understands the gravity of this task. And so it was that Brendan and his trusty hound started guarding the gate, offering admittance to no one save for the beautiful red-haired maiden on the beautiful grey-haired horse. Within 5 minutes, Brendan was asleep. His trusty hound, understanding the gravity of the task, tried to wake him up.
Wake up, he beseeched. My lord Brendan, you must wake up.
But Brendan slept on. Some minutes later, there was a knock at the gate. Brendan's trusty hound leapt up to the looking hole to spy what sort of visitor had come a-knocking. Zounds, it was a beautiful maiden on a beautiful horse. But alas, Brendan's trusty hound was a hound, and saw in black and white. And though this beautiful horse's hair appeared to be too dark a shade of grey to be actually be grey, it was far more likely a dark brown or black. Brendan's trusty hound couldn't be sure. So he rushed to his master and tried to wake him again.
My lord, awake, my lord, the maiden, my lord, it could be she, awake, awake.
But Brendan slept on. Time passed, and so did the beautiful maiden. And Brendan slept as the great clock ticked by for another hour. It seemed that Brendan was more devoted to ensuring he got his 8 hours every night than he was to protecting the kingdom. But his trusty hound kept guard and leapt to the looking hole once more when he heard a second visitor a-knocking. He appeared through, and would you believe it? It was another beautiful maiden on a beautiful horse. She truly was the most beautiful maiden Brendan's trusty hound had ever seen, and though he couldn't be certain, viewing things as he was through his monochrome filter, her hair seemed to be just the right sort of shade of grey as to be red, and the horse's hair was just a perfect shade of grey. Brendan's trusty hound could only assume it was indeed grey. More than this,
The beautiful maiden had a secretive look about her, a sort of look that suggested she possessed a great many secrets. And it was upon noticing this that Brendan's trusty hound was decided. It was she. But alas, Brendan's trusty hound was a hound and couldn't open the gate himself, so he tried once again to wake his master. "My lord," he screamed, "you must wake up, you must, it's her. The beautiful maiden is here, you must open the gate, my lord." But Brendan slept on. The following morning, when Brendan finally awoke and the kingdom was burning all around and the beautiful red-haired maiden and the beautiful grey-haired horse had been captured, tortured and the secret revealed, and the head had been removed and placed on a stake in the city square with a note that read, "I knocked, but no one heard," Brendan wiped the sleep from his eyes and turned to his trusty hound. "Why the hell didn't you wake me up, you useless mutt?"
"I did, my lord," replied the trusty hound. "I tried and tried, my lord. When first you fell asleep, I tried, but you slept on. I tried again when the first maiden appeared, but you slept on. I tried once more when the beautiful red-haired maiden and the beautiful grey-haired horse came and knocking, but you slept on. You would not wake, my lord."
But alas, Brendan's trusty hound was a hound, and as such was only capable of hound speak. And Brendan watched his trusty hound with disgust and could listen to the incessant barking no more. "The dog's deranged," he said, immediately had him put down. And feeling somewhat lonely after a day or two, Brendan bought a budgerigard and moved to a new kingdom.
Great! Thank you very much! That was The Great Story by Nigel Munson, but Brendan slept on. Thank you.
This is Cream Crackers by Alan McCormick. Mum always said I was simple but vain, a lethal cocktail in her book. Grandad said I was as smug as a bug in a rug, whatever that meant. But I've always had this notion that I could be a hero, something, someone to look up to, a pinnacle. "An icon, lad," Mum said. "They call this an icon. Not on a plinth to stare up at, but a fully fledged blood and guts hero. An icon." So how do I do it? "Do it," Mum said. "You're crackers, lad. Just stop with all the dirty talk. Your brain's made up of crumbs. Crackers, plain and simple, that's what you are." Jacob's cream, my brother used to call me. And he meant it in a sly, saucy, Old Testament way. "You'll end up with a permanent spot on Looney Tunes like your brother if you don't shut down the hero talk," Mum warned. My brother had shut it down. He'd followed the words of an angry bishop who said radical Muslims were damaging the status quo. We're always loyal to St. Francis, Rossi. My brother tried to crucify our neighbour, Mr. Khan's cat. Cat would have none of it and backed him up in an alleyway, clawed his face. I visited him by a new bed in the new room. "Cover my foot in coal dust and hand me a bandana," Grandad used to say to us when we were small. We had no idea what he meant, but it always made us laugh. I tried the line again, but my brother didn't even smile. "Still spitting crumbs, Jacob?" he asked, rubbing the scratches on his cheeks. When it was clear he wasn't returning, I tried to shut down the hero impulses for good. But the hero words just kept coming. Many years later, Mrs. Vance, who lived next door, got herself into a spot of bother. "I've got myself into a spot of bother, Thomas. That's my name. Please, please remember it." Sydney Grote was a moneylender, old school. Kneecap Sid, Cummins called him. One tap on each knee with a hammer for each day you were late with a payment. And Mrs. Vance was 4 days late. Plastic hips, plastic kneecaps and all. "Call me the bionic woman," she used to say whilst pulling out her dentures and then holding them above her head to make chopping shapes in the clouds. "Would you help an old woman in distress, Thomas?" she asked. "I'll sort it, whatever it is," I said. I lay in wait for his next visit. Tappy went on Mrs. Vance's door, which I was sure she felt as a deep threat in her knee bones. I burst out of a bush with my nephew Spider-Man's mask on. "Step back, Mr. Grote, or you'll be spinning in my web and eating worms for dinner." Another of Grandad's phrases. "Who the fuck are you?" "Jacob Cream," I said. He laughed, and this gave him my chance.
I took out my carrier bag. 5 pence, daylight bloody robbery, Mum would have said if she was still alive. And I pulled it over his head and I tied. His arms waved, his face made moving shadows inside the bag, an angry wide mouth. He fell onto his knees after a while. Mrs. Vance stepped out.
What have you gone and done? I only meant you to warn him off.
It's hard, this hero stuff. It's hard to know where to draw the line. I didn't fancy ending up sitting on a hospital bench next to my brother making hedgehogs from pine cones, so I ran. Mrs. Vance helped Mr. Grote up, and they looked down the street to see if they could spot me. Mrs. Vance should have got out her dentures. I was high up in the trees beside the clouds. And I'm up here now. If you look carefully, you can see fine crumbs falling from the sky when I speak. And if you're in trouble, I'll stop talking and come down and help you. Like most heroes, I'm a better listener than talker anyway. A transistor radio with knobs on and no battery inside, as Grandad used to say.
Brilliant. This next story is by Ruth Cedar, and it's called Just for One Day. Jesus, Paul shuffled about, trying to avoid chunks of broken glass. What happened here then? Rob, the repairman, snorted with bad temper. Same as always, he flew in and fucked off, leaving us to sort out this mess. Rob spread his arms wide. It'll take ages, just look at it. Paul inspected the room around him. He stood next to a gaping hole where the floor-to-ceiling window had been, and there was shattered glass everywhere. It covered the floor, the office furniture, and even a photo frame had been broken in the blast. A pot plant had been burnt at the edges and knocked over, leaving wet soil in the pile. There was an armchair leaking stuff in, and another that was shredded down to the wooden frame. The carpet was pulling away from the floor in places, slashed in others. It really was a state, like a localised bomb blast. It's the second time this month a clean-up team had been called about to sort out this office block. The first time had been the penthouse, which had to be rebuilt from scratch. This time it was the fifth floor. He carefully documented everything on his clipboard. So, what happened? What was it this time? Paul said. Rob pulled on a pair of sturdy gloves and passed a pair to Paul.
The usual, Rob said,
as he began to scoop broken glass into a box.
I don't think we've got it easy doing the inside. There's guys down there having to sort out the bloody tarmac again.
He gestured to the street below, where trucks were already beginning to pull up. Soon the other workers joined them, the glaziers for the windows, upholsterers for the shedded armchairs, and drapers to fill the blind that flapped limply in the gaping hole where the window glass should have been. They were the only ones in the building. They'd been evacuated half an hour ago. Despite the chaos in the city, the building had to be restored to work in order. The mayor said it was important for the city aesthetic. The television was still working somehow. It seemed the power wasn't entirely out on this floor. A rolling news broadcast showed a major bridge in the city covered in red and blue police lights, dozens of backed-up vehicles and a helicopter circling overhead. Excited journalists were speaking rapidly into the camera. The television was silent, but the message was clear. Something bad was happening. The camera swung wildly, glimpses of people running, screaming, abandoning their cars and running to underground stations to take cover. A dust cloud bubbled up and then smoke, lots of smoke. The journalist was running now too. The shaky camera reminded Paul of a rubbish horror films, the kind where 5 kids go into the woods, but this was actually happening. It was happening more often these days. Meanwhile, leather was carefully laid and cut, stuffing was wrestled back into place and the armchairs were put right. Rubber sealant was applied to fix the new panes of glass, filthy with dusty fingerprints, soon to be wiped away by the small army of cleaners who had turned up to help. Sirens wailed in the streets below, horns blaring to move people out of the way. Crowds gathered around huge television screens and people clutched their babies in desperation.
"Do you do this a lot then, Rob?" Paul said. Concealing the grin, he said, "Do you, come here often?"
Rob straightened up from his kneeling position.
"Look, Paul, I'm not paying you to be hilarious. You document and you establish order. Just bloody get on with it, yeah?"
Paul tutted. He glanced back up at the television. The journalists were now crouched in what looked like a tube tunnel,
Dozens of scared people hid behind her as she continued to speak rapidly into the camera. The picture cut to a shot being filmed from a helicopter. It's hard to see anything amongst the smoke and the flames and the flashing lights of the police cars. Fire engines pulled up and formed a blockade. And on the screen, Paul saw glimpses of a man, a big man by the looks of him. The man crouched down to bumper level, put his hands on the vehicle, and then the image cut to a black screen. And somewhere on the streets below, he heard a tremendous crash and people screaming. Paul shrugged and scooped the last of the glass shards into the box and then taped it up. He fetched a broom and helped the cleaners for a bit. He carefully took the photograph out of the smashed frame. It showed four smiling faces, a little nuclear family. He placed it in a drawer. Rob sat back on his heels and mopped his brow. The carpet was taking ages. They couldn't lay a new one today, so they had to gaffer tape any slash bits to stop any trip hazards. The problem now was the floor with more tape than carpet. Someone was filling a hole in the wall, and another person was touching it in the peeled paint. He glanced to the street and could see the tarmac guys were already working on repairing the giant school marks on the ground. What a mess. He had wanted to say, "Yes, I do come here all the time," to Paul, when he had asked. It had become ridiculous how often his team were being called out to clear-ups like this. He'd repaired a room in nearly every floor of this damn building. He should have had his own plaque above the entrance. Rob Michaels, Master of Repairs. Something like that would do.
"Right, let's start to wrap this up now, guys," Rob said.
He stood and dusted off his hands. The rubber putty in the window would take some time to go off properly, but it was fixed for now. The carpet was a crisscross of silver tape, and the burn marks on the pot plant have to be sorted out later on. The team had worked hard and done their best. It's a shame no one would thank them for it. The television screen crackled back into life. Whatever happened on the bridge seemed to be over. The picture showed people flooding back into the streets, cheering and waving. The flashing police lights still covered the bridge, well, half of it. The other half had been upended into the river, taking cars and vans with it. They bobbed merrily on the surface like toy boats before sinking into the river's sludge. Some idiot had found the inevitable tiny flags visible at all such events and handed them out. Banners fluttered in the breeze and a parade was starting. A marching band appeared from God knows where, all pressed uniforms and shining brass. Children ate ice cream amongst the ashes of the pavement. Finally, sound was restored to the television. The journalist was all smiles as she said, "The city is safe once more." Rob shook his head. "Fucking Superman," he said. "And that's Rusinar for just for one day. Got it right in the end. Well, that was all our story, so thank you very much for the part one of the Heroes and Villains podcast. I'm Ian Bernadette. We'll be back very soon for the next one. So thanks to all our writers, as usual. Brilliant stories, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.